Hello and welcome to the Off-Track Racing Show presented by BikeMag.com. We're coming at you from Worcester, BC in our studio. Summer has hit in the last week. It is hotter than all can be. Trails are drying out, getting a little dusty out there already. So you know it's summertime when summer gravity camps are in full effect. Crankworks France is happening right now as we speak. And this is the Off-Track Show. I'm your host, Tristan Merrick. We have a great show lined up for you guys today. Lots to talk about. Les de Elp Enduro World Series Crankworks took place this past weekend, which means that's their last round in the in Europe right now. The next one will be taking place in North America. So I think there's more than a few racers that are beyond happy with that news. But of course, lots and lots of action to talk about that took place over there. We have two guests for you guys today. We've got none other than the Silverback himself. Sven Martin is going to call in a little bit later on. We're going to catch up with him, working on some time zone differences right now, so hopefully things can link up. And we're going to get a little first-hand knowledge of exactly what's been going on the course over there this past weekend. Of course, I think we'll probably touch on Val d'Alos last weekend. Two back-to-back weekends, lots of exciting racing taking place, and two very different and distinct rounds. And our second guest on today's show, we weren't able to get him last week. Unfortunately, he kind of dropped off the radar, but we've tracked him down due to some unfortunate events. We won't see him at the next couple of rounds, but we got Giant Factory Racing's Josh Carlson. Josh, if you guys may remember, is placed 10th in the opening round in Punta Ala. Was definitely poised to have a bit of a breakout year. This is the kind of racing that's tailor-made for him. He's kind of new to the game, so he's kind of laying down his own tracks ahead of him. He hasn't been born and raised within mountain bike racing like a lot of these guys. So let's just jump straight into our results here. What a race we had. Jerome Clements coming out. He got his win, and he did it very tactically. He did kind of what Fabian did in round number one from Punta Ala. He went out. He knew what stage to attack on, which was the first one, and put a 25-second margin into Nicholas Vullio. So Vullio, no slouch on the bike, last week's winner. So Clements puts 25 seconds into him and then effectively just goes into managing the rest of his day. He pulled a fifth, a sixth, and a sixth in the final three stages there. So great racing from Jerome. It's weird to say it, but we kind of thought we all knew he was going to do it. It almost seemed like it was taking too long, yet it was only the third round of the Enduro World Series here. So great to see him have that breakout ride and not have any misfortunes on the track. As I said, second place, Nicholas Vullio. He got one stage win there on stage two, and then a second, a ninth, and a fifth there. So he's on the gas. This week's a little different than last week's. Only about 40 minutes of racing. So we've seen all different things here. We've seen the first round where it was about 20, 21 minutes worth of racing. Second round, we saw 60 minutes racing. And then into the third round here, we saw about 40 minutes racing. And then creeping into that third spot on the podium, none other than Sam Blenkinsop. So one of the youngster downhillers, just kind of coming out, and he pulling some good ones. He got the final win on the fourth stage there with a nice 6:01. So he won by 2 seconds. But all his other ones, a third, a sixth, a fifth, so consistently up there. So it's rounding it out, we saw Dan Atherton manage to have a good one. First stage, though, not looking good, falling back in 14th place there. He was saying afterwards that he was, why am I out here? He's been sick, bit of a chest infection, so not the start of it that he wanted to there. And then he pulled it together, put his shit in a pile, and managed to pull out a seventh, a second, and a second on the rest of the remainder of the stages. So great to see there. One guy that was caught up with bad luck was Jared Graves. He was chit-chatting afterwards. Again, a new event. It doesn't have the same the same long standing as the first two rounds where, Val d'Alos has been around for 10 years. This is a completely new event. So maybe not as much course taping as there should have been. what happened to Jared was he was full pinned going down there in the wide open Alpine section, was looking, using the tape as a bit of a brake marker, and didn't see the tape because it actually had broken, so he had blown right off the course and didn't realize until he was about 50 meters down. So he had to pick up everything, run back up the hill. He didn't want to be considered one of them cheaters by cutting the course or anything like that, so ran back up there. So still a solid showing from Jared Graves, rounding that out as our top six there. And Jerome Clements is now your points leader for the overall. And as far as with the women, Tracy Mosley, 3-for-3 now. We did not get to see the Battle Royale I think we were all waiting for and hoping for when ACC came back from injury there after what happened in that first round. So Tracy still taking, a kind of a commanding lead there. She's 3-for-3, hasn't really been challenged yet. It'll be interesting to see what happens when we jump across here. So jump across to our next round. But cool to see. I mean, our first round, Enrico Aguala had his chance in the spotlight. Then second round, Fred Glow. It was all him at Val d'Alos. And it was now Darren Kinnaird's turn with the Crankworks crew. And cool to see all three of these guys working together. I mean, Fred Glow was up there on his trials bike, putting down markers. Enrico out on the course flagging with the rest of those guys. So the spirit of enduro seems to be alive and well, it's exciting times, exciting racing. So, but let's change things up here. We're going to go into our first guest, that is Sven Martin, and we're going to catch up with him, get the lowdown of what happened on track there, and figure out get some behind the scenes stuff, because this is a guy that is on the side of the course. This is also the same guy that that helped pulled our second guest out of the woods there, Josh Carlson from Val d'Alos, when he had his incident. So it'll be good to catch up with Sven here. So Sven, let's just lay the groundwork here. Three rounds, three different winners, three different formats. What's the difference, and what's the take that we're getting out on course here from all the riders?
You know, it's every one of these events been a completely different feel and culture and style. From the Italian to the French one in Val d'Alos, and this one still being French, it still has its own style and type of riding. And we've been coming into Les Deux Alpes for Mountain of Hell for a number of years now, the last 5 years or so. So to us, it was no surprise, and to riders that had been here, the kind of riding and terrain I don't know how to describe it. Definitely steep, but also not necessarily flowy, just steep and jerky and erratic, and then a combination of on and off, some going crossing piste, and then bridging into not very well used hiking trail, and then just brand new trail. So that's kind of the style of riding here, the kind of keep it a surprise, and it's kind of like trail finding and just steep mountain riding. So different to a flowy bike, I wouldn't say bike park feel, because Val d'Alos, although it was a bike park, it didn't feel like a bike park, but you're pretty much on your brakes the whole time. So for a lot of people it was a huge surprise, and some people liked it and some people didn't. And then you throw in a bunch of really big technical, and then some, just flat out dangerous and risky and exposed terrain. Wasn't everyone's cup of tea, but then other people really loved it and cracked on with it. So, I think the terrain caught people by surprise somewhat. And then I guess the other things that will pop up, after the event and during the event and just kind of before the event, wasn't quite as smoothly organized, I would say, or the level of preparation by the sort of race promoter. It's sort of a tough gig marrying up the Crankworx organization with the local people on the ground here in Les Deux Alpes, and they hadn't hosted an enduro round before. So when they thought they had a track ready for Crankworx and Enduro World Series, they sort of had it ready the Mountain of Hell style, very
bit of a free-for-all.
Bit of a free-for-all. And the thing is, in the Mount of Hell and the Megastar race, because it's a mass start, you know, you have gates. You don't have to tape a lot of track at all because everyone knows the intended route, and you have gates that you got to kind of go between. And the thing is, because you're racing mass, you're always seeing fellow racers. So even if you've got a 10-kilometer track, which you can't tape 10 kilometers of track, and that's just one track, you have the usual thing is if more than one racer reports another racer, you know, because you've got back numbers, and then that's how people – that basically stops people from cheating, or, you know, you can't blow tape because there isn't tape. You kind of got to go around gates or between gates, which can be ineffective in this high alpine kind of riding. So here it was a bit tricky when you need to tape courses because you've got solo riders on the course, and, you know, you can't have 100 marshals on one track. You know, this is not, you know, this is not what it's about. So it's not the matter that, you know, a lot of people have been talking about cheating, but there's been a lot of I wouldn't say there's been cheating, but, you know, when you're on grass and off camber and you can't make a turn and you blow through tape, you know, sometimes it's that you get back on track, or you hike back up to where you blew off, but you're not going to stop and fix the tape. So the next guy that comes down, you know, he doesn't even see the tape, so he might, you know, either go off track and get lost and goes and then have to, you know, realize he's off track, or the opposite is if it happens on a sort of a bunch of switchbacks going down a hill, then
Jared Graves, I guess, is that kind of perfect example, right? He blew through the tape, the tape was already ripped. He was all of a sudden kind of realized he'd missed a corner, and he was already about 50 meters down the track there, and ended up having to, you know, in the spirit of enduro, as he puts it, hike back up, because he didn't want to just cut across and get caught, or and then get disqualified, or just know in the back of his head that he didn't do what he would have liked to have done and stayed on track. So
in some cases it's clear that you can rejoin the track quicker than going back up to where you left the track. Other times you know, you might blow the tape, or the tape's not there, and you might not find the track. You know, you might actually never rejoin the track. So, you know, and that's and as Jared he definitely said, when you only have one day of practice or one or even two runs of practice, you rely on the tape to guide you. That's your breaking points, and that's where the corners are, and you kind of just instinctively rely on that. You know, you don't have enough practice to remember, you know, four tracks and a couple of kilometers on each track, especially at those speeds. So that, you know, that was an unfortunate incident, and but not one easily solved. That section, because of its steepness and the amount of turns and the potential to rejoin the track in another place, perhaps, yeah, there should have been more marshals there than at other places. But you can't marshal everywhere. I have a couple of solutions, I think, that might work for this. And a couple of us have talked about it and proposed it. And we can get onto that in a second, because we can almost do that as a separate little topic, but I'd rather, you know, I don't want to focus or talk about cutting the courses or cheating, because really it was you know, that's going to happen at any kind of race, even a regular short, well-watched, well-marshaled downhill race, you know. But a lot of what people sort of were talking about is like we saw riders innocently on this one section on stage two, you know, the tape was right on the track on a cliff, but a ledge, you know, like a 6-8 foot ledge.
Yeah.
And another rider had, you know, blown through the tape. And now you have the next set of riders, they used the last bit of tape to set up, okay, now after that pole, I can turn it because it's safe, you know. And two or three riders got to the end of the tape, but literally there was meant to be another 8 feet of tape. Mm. And they turned, and they basically had to like bail off their bike and you know, sort of tumbled and slid down slid down the section. And so in that instance, you know, it's not cheating, but there's no way to get back up on the course. And another rider basically got to the edge of this cliff, old James Shirley from Scotland, and he just, you know, he was offline by basically 8 feet because there was 8 feet of tape missing. And I don't know how he did it, but he basically just yanked up, and he had a really big straight line with a drop in practice. But now he had ended up basically doing a drop about 8 feet higher because, you know, he was on another basically higher section of ledge, and he pulled it off. But, you know, technically, I guess he cut the course, but there was actually no more tape there to cut by the time he went, you know. So it's tough. It's a tough one.
Difficult, right? Like you were saying, I mean, we're three events in. The first two events are so highly established, especially last weekend. That's been going for 10 years, and
yeah. And so they know the problem areas and the problem points, and you tape or mark out or marshal accordingly, you know. So this one, it was sort of the final touches to the courses were maybe put on a bit later than normal, and then part of that is the organizers wanting to keep it secret so you don't have locals practicing, because a lot of this was on, you know, a lot of new trail and a lot of combination of old hiking trails. So it was quite level playing fields, really, this event, which was good. And it was very, very different kind of riding. It was a lot steeper, a much bigger, much longer climb, and a lot more technical. So it had, you know, more physical, but it had more downhill and more technical. And, so it favored a lot of different kind of riders, you know. So it was a great event for sure, and great scenery and testing both bodies and bikes and brakes in a completely different way to what we've seen so far.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess I want to ask you, we're three rounds and it was another different format. I mean, what's the feel out there? You know, we've had the first round this year, we had 20 minutes worth of racing. Then last weekend, we had an hour worth of racing. Now we had 40 minutes worth of racing. How is everybody kind of adapting and enjoying each different format where, you know, first one, you could practice a ton. Last weekend, you got, you know, you did a sight lap and then you raced it. And this weekend, you had a full day, but you had to be careful not to, you know, blow yourself out because then you had to race it the next day.
Yeah, I mean, there's no one that's better than the other. You know, I think whether the guys are doing 12,000 meters of descending over 2 days or 34, you know, an hour of racing or 34 minutes of racing, or the big 50K pedal at Punta Ala, I think the riders are equally taxed by all of them. You know, it's weird. Like, an hour of racing 12,000 meters doesn't mean it's tougher or more physical than 34 minutes of racing and just four stages. It's quite a bizarre thing, and that's really what makes this whole series and each event quite something special, because there is no one formula or event or that outshines the other. I mean, everyone will have their favorites or have their favorite stages, and you know, I personally like the Val de Loss format as a photographer, to one pre-ride, and then you know the riders are kind of within order and they're all in the one stage, because you know, when people are practicing on the Saturday here, everyone's on at their own place and they practicing on their own time frame and on their own stages, so you know it's hard to see all the riders. So every different incarnation is it's working, and you know, and that's the whole point of it, is to let each host kind of do it in their flavor, you know. I don't think there needs to be liaisons in the middle of summer if we can be riding in the Alps. You know, you don't want to be at places along the coast where there's no ski lifts right now, because the temperatures would be in the 40s in Europe, where they've had a bit of a heat wave and that just broke till today, you know. So it all works out. And then come the end of the year in October, when there's snow in the Alps again, you know, then we're backpedaling on the coastal areas of Fenai. So it all comes around.
Cool. Yeah, no, I mean, it's awesome to see, you know, with the photos you're putting out there. I mean, that Enrico's at that round, and Fred Glow's still at that round, and Darren's at that round. Like, all these guys are, you know, each round, all of a sudden, all three of them are there. You know, I know Enrico was out flagging course like crazy, and Fred was out there with his trials bike putting out markers and stuff. It's cool to see the unity so far. I mean, being three rounds in, and we've had three completely different winners so far. I mean, Jerome putting his kind of stamp of approval that he's here and he means business, putting in 25 seconds on second place on that first stage. I mean, what did he do different, or you know, or is that just what we should have expected the first two rounds, but they haven't gone to plan?
No, Jerome has had some bad luck, one could say, but he's a smart guy. He's a strategist, and you know, even when he's had bad luck, he's always never been that far down, because he's done what it takes to mitigate the problems.
Stick with us, folks. We'll be right back with more of the Off Track Racing Podcast.
Take my hand and come with me, because you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. I say you look so fine that I really want to make you mine. 4, 5, 6, come on and get your kicks. Now you don't need money with a face like that, do ya?
Yeah, another weekend for Burrell, unfortunately, also. I mean, that's got to be a little frustrating for him.
Yeah, Burrell's always been the guy in the World Cup downhill that's, you know, he won world championships. He didn't win downhill World Cup rules because he's the guy that could perform on the day, but he pushed so hard and everything into it that there's always so much risk and so much that can go wrong. You know, the enduro racing of 2-3 years ago, where you're just managing your bike and your body and riding at 80% and not making mistakes, that's all gone out the window this year. These guys are going, you know, they're going almost at 100%, and with that, you know, you're gonna get Jerome Flattered fucking said. It is more than his share now, and Nico Flattered and Caroline Flattered. And these are, you know, not because of bad tire or tire pressure or rim combinations. It's just that's the nature of the beast when you're doing this kind of ride, trying to get away with light. And there's not very many people that are even just running simple extra tires. You know, these are 2-ply racing tires, you know.
Yeah,
it's become the nature of
races. They're pushing it hard, that's for sure. Each and every round. So it's go ahead.
Oh no, I should just say, you know, we're going to see, you know, a lot more of this, you know, and it's interesting seeing the downhillers, you know, Loic, Bruni, and Blenkinsop both winning a stage. And That's a pretty big thing for, you know, Menard did it after quite a few tries. And now to have those guys, you know, it says a lot about this venue, you know, those local stages that Blinky and Bruni won and Nico on the second one. So, you know, but at the end of the day, you've got to be a full package enduro rider, and that's what Jerome is, and that's why he's leading the overall, and, you know, that's why he won this one, you know. I think a lot of people expected him to win one sooner, even though we are only three races in. So, you know, he's got that checked off now.
Yeah, he's got that. Yeah, the monkey off his back there. And I mean, I don't think, mind you, there was no monkey. And yeah, that's the first swing through Europe is done and dusted. And next event for these guys, well, other smaller events, but the next Enduro World Series coming to North America, going to Colorado, and then up to Whistler here. Do we think that there's going to be much of a, obviously we'll see a bit of a change moving from a European based racetracks to these North American ones, or is this the same top five going to be the same top five? Or are we going to see Curtis have a breakout ride being back on home soil and a few of the other guys?
Well, I think that riding is going to be a lot more predictable, especially at Winter Park, which means it's going to be a lot tighter, there's smaller time gaps. So you might even get 10th at Winter Park in a stage time, but you might still be within only 2-3 seconds. So I think what's going to be key at Winter Park is some guys are going to get there last minute to deal with the altitude adjustment, which is one way of dealing with it. The other people are going to go there for, you know, more than a week. And, you know, it's going to be, the altitude's going to be a huge factor. And you can't really say if you can or cannot adapt to that. You know, a lot of people live at sea level around here, or someone like Martin Mays below sea level. So, I think Winter Park, I think the altitude's going to affect people more than the actual riding and the stages. And for what they've had thrown at them in the last three rounds, it's going to be tough to match that and with difficulty and technical. But simple trails ridden faster become, you know, just as difficult. So, I think I think the same guys will still be up there, but it'll be a lot easier for someone, say, like Curtis or those other guys to be a lot higher up in the ranks, because I don't think there'll be as much separating the riders. It'll just be more physical than anything else. So, interesting. And then obviously people like Graves and Dan Atherton, if they can practice the course a lot, and it's kind of a pack specific trail that those guys have been, you know, from downhill background and four cross background, and you know, Graves knows those tracks in Colorado. He's used to that high altitude, being a Yeti rider, and I don't want to put money on anyone, but a pretty safe bet to say, you know, you could probably expect Graves to possibly win that one, or be the man to beat for Colorado at least. And then Whistler, I don't know. We'll have to see what Whistler comes up with. You know, they've got a potential to have one of the best rounds, and let's just see what trails end up being in the race.
Yeah, very, very exciting to see what comes out of Whistler. And yeah, I'm with you. Not to be biased, but you can't really bet against Jared down in Colorado. He learned a lot down there as a young Yeti rider, and with the Norbas and everything like that, especially with. If it's super dry and dusty and blown out, I mean, that could play heavily in his favor for that round later this month. So it'll be good times come then. And I, one thing I did wanted to touch base with you on, because I mean, obviously we're producing this in Canada, and most of the North Americans, I mean, enduro being so new, I wanted to ask you, who is kind of who's your under the radar guy? Because there's so many names when you flip through the result sheet here, that aren't, you know, they're not household names. They're not the people that you see all the time. And obviously, I think you do a great job of bringing awareness to all these other riders on the slideshow on Vital there, which I think is amazing. But who's your kind of two or three guys that you think are
well? There's a lot of guys that are close, and like I said, you might be 17th or 10th in a stage, but when you look at the time gap or who the riders are ahead of you, you know these guys, riders like Jamie Nicol from New Zealand, who's sleeping in a tent on a tennis court, as are a lot of people, a lot of privateers that are beating a lot of fully factory sponsored riders, and then you get, you know, there's so many, there's such a huge depth of European talent that you won't know. You know, Nicholas Query really, there's Gary Forrest, all the Scottish guys, and there's so much talent, you know, as a photographer, you notice a lot of style and type of riding, but you know, sometimes the best looking riders aren't necessarily the fastest. So it's a tough one. You know, even Oscar Sayers, he's a giant giant factory racing Daniel coach. He entered this because he's basically wants to sending an enduro to help. More, and Josh is looking forward to having him, and he did. You know, he's. he must be 8 years, so he got like top 30 in some stages. I think he finished like 33rd or something at his first ever go at enduro. So
yeah, 35th overall, with his top stage being the third one of 26th place. So
yeah, so and then, you know, there's a lot of riders who their results aren't showing their depth of their talent, you know, as bike riders. Joe Barnes is, you know, it's surprising he hasn't been more up there on their result sheet, but when you see the lines and the way he's riding sections in front of you, you know you can't understand, maybe he's having problems go further down the course. But you know, there's some bike riding that I witnessed this weekend that was especially when we get, as the photographers, we're moving around, you know, we, you know, it's not just like walking down your track taking photos, and then, you know, you don't really get a true sense of a say yourself, you know, on the same kind of bike. So, you know, that for me, that's the best part of enduro. I can ride my bike down, you know, 100% of the trails that the races are going down as well. So, you know, you get a better understanding for the tracks and appreciate some of the lines these guys are picking, and I'm doing it in 2 minute intervals every time I stop, and these guys are doing it back to back, you know, 15-10 minute stages.
Yeah, very, very physically demanding out of these guys. So, but yeah, I think we'll let you go here, Sven, because unfortunately, just with time differences, I know it's late at night over there for you, and I appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the Off Track Show. And what's next on the adventure? Are you off to Mega later this week, or?
We back and forth between working, shooting the downhill and the slopestyle here in Ledo Alp, and then we'll be shooting across the valley to practice and shoot some stuff around in and around the Mega, and then there's Mega qualifying and finals. And the Mega this year will be quite interesting because it's going to definitely be different, both the qualifier and the racetrack. The snowpack and the snow depth here is it's going to be huge changes, and within the next day or two, the organizers are going to basically let us know the race route. The qualifier route has already been moved to lower lift just because of the snowpack this year in Europe. So
just a lot more snowpack than normal. Is that?
Yeah, just a very huge late winter, and it hasn't warmed up until the last few weeks, and even then at the altitudes, it's not, you know, it's not hot enough to melt the snow. So yeah, the Mega should be, yeah, the Mega's going to be interesting because a lot of the normal Mega riders, the top riders, not all of them are doing the Mega this year because they've committed to the whole series and they either want to save themselves and not risk anything, or they basically, you know, don't have the budget to do everything if they're going to get themselves over to North America. So yeah, there should be, you know, it'll be interesting to see the results this coming weekend. And we've had rain all day today, so who knows what the weather will be like by the weekend for the Mega.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks again for joining us here, and I guess we'll have to catch up with you. Are you heading to Andorra, or are you heading to Colorado?
Shoot, that's still a while away. We've got
that's Mega. Because that's the same weekend at the end of the month, isn't it? So that's our first conflict weekend that we're coming across. So
yeah, so before that, we've got another conflict. There's a Mountain of Hell race back here in Ledo Alp, as well as the Salzy Super Enduro. So there's those two events on the following weekend before Colorado, and then I'll be in Andorra. So I won't be going to Colorado, and I won't be going to Whistler. So it's a bit of a shame, especially with, you know, you got a lot of interest from the downhillers like the Syndicate and the Lapierre guys. So it's, you know, it's obviously summer's only so long, so it's not always going to work out. But, you know, sometimes you'd think you could make it, some of it work out anyway. So we'll be a bummer to miss those two, but I'll be watching and listening on Off Track.
Oh, right on. Well, thanks, man. We'll have to catch up with you. We're still working on our game plan here of what we'll be doing for those double conflict weekends, if we'll make the show a little longer, or how we'll work out that formula. It's you know, we give one of those sports more priority than the other. I'm sure there'll be people who are disappointed that they wanted more enduro coverage or they wanted more downhill coverage. So we'll have to figure that out. But thanks
maybe
for
we'll have to have a, maybe we'll have to have a conference, and then just go back and forth and just free flowing discussion about the two. Just you know.
I like the sounds of that. For the next one, we'll get Seb and myself in studio here, and we'll have a. We'll get you on the horn there, and it'll be a little easier, only 3 hours ahead, and we'll have a spirited discussion of what's going on in the both sports over the weekend.
I'm sure it will be a spirited discussion if Seb's around here.
Cool, Sven. Well, thanks very much for joining us here, and safe travels in the next little bit, and we'll keep in touch.
All right. See you, Tristan.
All right, and always great having Sven Martin part of the off-track show here. Giving us really a behind the scenes and very intimate view of what's going on at each and every round, and just so many stories. I wish we could always have more time with him each and every time we get him on the show here. So much information to pass on. So good to see his take there. Shame that we're going to be missing out on getting him into town here. We thought we were going to have him on the show during the Enduro World Series when it's visiting us during Crankworx Whistler, but our next two events kind of being a bit of a conflict here. Obviously, Winter Park, Colorado is the Enduro World Series, and the Andorra World Cup taking place at the same time, and then the following event being Mount St. Anne World Cup, and of course the Enduro World Series taking place here in Whistler. So we'll have to get him on the line there. I think we'll have, especially for the Andorra Winter Park episode, it could be some spirited conversation and everything. So, and joining us right now, we've got none other than Giant Factory Racings from all the way from the Wollongong, Australia. We've got Josh Carlson. Josh, how's it going?
Good, man. It's good to be back in Vancouver and back out of a non-English speaking French hospital, which is always handy to talk to people who understand what you're saying. It's good to be back.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's obviously due to the injury and internet connections. I don't think most of our listeners and most people out there that are following the Enduros really know what happened. It just showed that you didn't finish one of the stages. I know Vital had a little thing that just said, he had to go to the hospital. And just due to, you know, the back-to-back rounds and people moving on, I mean, maybe you can bring us up to speed what happened here. You had a pretty big get-off that put you down on the ground pretty hard.
Yeah, it was a bit of a get-off for sure. After Saturday's stages in Val d'Alos, it was an eye-opening experience, to say the least, you know, to see how the Frenchies attack these Enduros, and they're just outright raw speed. You know, that's a skill all on its own, and those guys are just masters at it. So after Saturday stages, I showed up to Sunday with a kind of new outlook. I was just relaxed and I was committed to just having a crack and letting go a little bit, you know, like I was a little bit off the pace on Saturday, and we kind of analyzed it a bit. So I wanted to attack Sunday pretty good, and the first stage of Sunday was a long, pretty grueling. I think at the time it was like my first practice run, because we get one sighting run of the race stage and then we go straight into our race run. So my sighting stage took about 20 minutes to just roll down the whole course at, you know, 70-80%. So got through that, was feeling great. The track was rowdy, to say the least. It was virgin through wide open grassy, slippery fields and like off camber goat trails across the mountainside, and it was awesome. Shitloads of pedaling, heaps of gnar, heaps of steep stuff, and it was all really raw. So, you know, it was pretty cool. And so I come into my race run. I felt good, relaxed and focused and just centered. I caught my 22nd guy within the first, like, 3 minutes of my race run. I could see the dude ahead. Yeah, I could see the guy ahead of him. You know, like, you can see a lot of the track, but I could already see him just up in front, like amongst the trail. So I felt good and I felt like I was riding pretty well. But yeah, come down into this wide open section that was dropping down a hill, and then it kind of, the track veered to the right, dropped, then turned left to go through a creek bed.
Yeah.
And then up the other side. But I came in way too hot and actually kind of misread the trail in front of me, and because I came in too hot, I was forced to go straight or like just plow my nose into a, I don't know, I guess it was maybe a foot, 2 foot high, pretty round tree stump.
Yeah.
So I opted to huck it, thinking there was just grass on the other side, but on the other side was like a, probably a 15 foot drop into just like a pretty rowdy creek bed. It was full of like microwave sized rocks. So in my head, as I'm in the air, I'm like, yeah, I can ride this out. And then next thing I know, I'm picking myself up the ground with that, you know, that feeling we've pretty much all had of that winded feeling where I had nothing left in my body and everything hurt and I just couldn't figure out where the pain was. I grabbed my bike, which was behind me a few feet, and tried to jump on and ride it, but that wasn't happening. And I was trying to sling my left arm around. I could feel my collarbone was still in place and something was wrong. And I just was like, I could kind of move it, but it just felt bizarre. It felt foreign. And so that was kind of rough. So yeah, I just kind of meandered around the grassy paddock out of the creek for a little while, screaming for someone to come and help me, and literally screaming help.
Yeah.
So it was kind of scary at the time. And then, realized I was kind of in no man's land, and you know, no one, it was such a fast section that no one could understand me when they came past. And it's a race, you know, like everyone's flying past and racing, and it looked like I just had a flat tire. So I just walked down this real steep trail afterwards and found a marshal who didn't speak a word of English, and found him. Then he somehow managed to call these paramedics up the trail, and they cut my jersey and my thing off, and I had a bit of a hole in my arm, and I still didn't really know what was wrong. But anyway, we walked down off the trail, and my leg was killing me, my back was killing me, I could barely breathe. I was in a bit of a dark place, which was not ideal. And then got off the trail and got into an ambulance and saw Sven. He was coming out of the trail with a camera in his hand, and I was just like, it was good to see. It was a relief to see Sven because I knew he could speak English.
Yeah.
I was just like, Sven, you got to get my bike. I can't leave my bike up on the hill. You've got to get it for me. And
it's a prototype. I got to get it back to the rig.
Yeah. I was trying to explain that to the marshal because I think they were saying, like, we leave here and I'll bring it back. And I'm like, no, it can't stay here.
Yeah.
No one can have this bike.
So yeah.
I was a bit dinged up and not exactly in an ideal place, but I was still worried about my bike. So anyway, I saw Sven and just said, oh, Sven, I'm in a bad way. You got to help me, dude. And he helped get me into the ambulance, which carted me off the track. I eventually made my way down to the town of Alos. And like I said, I was freaking right out. I thought I'd done some seriously major damage. And I was not happy. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, what happened in the end there? I mean, so you smoke this rock, you crawl out of there, you're in a hospital where, you're from Australia, and you probably, you know, seem like a foreign alien to the Frenchies there. I mean, you can't really communicate. I mean, did you know you'd have to go in for surgery right away, or was it just kind of like roll with the punches? I mean, what was taking place?
Well, it was kind of roll with the punches. Like I said, I got taken down. I didn't see anyone from when I left from my race run, and I saw all the guys at the top of the hill and high fiving and okay, we'll see you, have a good run, blah blah blah. Sent it. That's it. I didn't see anyone again until I was in the hospital in the next town, because we went down to the hospital in Alos, and it's only a small town, so they didn't have the you know, resources to check me out fully.
Yeah.
You know, they got all my clothes off and they could see it, but they couldn't x-ray me properly, and I couldn't stand up because my leg was so sore and I hit my quad so hard. And
yeah.
And so they packed me up in an ambulance. And by this stage, our soigneur, Amanda, she can speak fluent French, which was amazing. It was an absolute godsend.
Yeah.
Godsend. So by this stage, she had been down to the hospital in Alos, and she could speak to these guys and kind of communicate with me, translate with me what they were thinking about doing, and that turned into me getting put into the back of another ambulance, like a proper ambulance.
Yeah.
And then we had to drive an hour and a half down the valley to the next town, which had a real hospital. You know, it was a bigger, proper town, had a real hospital, and then they could x-ray me, and we could go through the motions about finding out what was wrong. You know, because all I was certain my shoulder was dislocated, but there was a lot of blood. Like, my shorts were covered and stained in blood, and at the end of my jersey was covered in blood, and I couldn't see on the other side of my elbow what was wrong. And all I knew was my elbow and my shoulder and my ribs and my back were just so sore, the most pain I've ever been in. So yeah, we got carted into the next town, into the next hospital, and again, I just kind of fumbled my way through this language that me and this the ambulance officer made, and I learned Savar, which is good.
Yeah.
And I just learned to kind of make up a number between 1 and 10 to where my pain was at.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we made it to the next town where they could x-ray me, do some CT scans, check out my back, x-ray my leg, my right hand, my elbow, all that stuff. And I could finally get some painkillers about 3 or 4 hours after I'd crashed. So that was handy. That was probably the best thing of that whole day, is finally getting some painkillers.
Yeah.
So, and then, yeah, so it turned out that I had had a pretty solid gash in my arm, looked like a vagina. And so they stitched that back up with about 6 or 7 stitches.
Yeah.
And that's explained where all the blood came from. And then my elbow had been broken into 3 pieces. My scapula, the end of my scapula bone, my shoulder blade, had been fractured all the way through, which, you know, hold it cups you the ball of your humerus.
Yeah.
Your bicep bone.
Yeah.
So that had been fractured, and I'd snapped a rib in half and just fractured another rib, and I just had a humongous cork. I think I bruised the bone maybe on my left quad as well as dinging up my right hand, and I thought I smashed all the back of my hand and my knuckle, where that turned out to be just a bruised hand, which was handy. Jeez. So I was in a bit of a state, that's for sure.
Dude, that's just describing what happened there. I mean, that's part of me wants to say you got really lucky, and my other part says, well, you didn't get very lucky. But I mean,
in my head, I felt like I was totally lucky, because I was in a serious amount of pain, and it was, you know, without fail, the biggest crash I've ever had in my entire life, whether racing mountain bikes, racing motocross, riding bicycles as a kid, you know, this was the fastest, biggest crash I've ever had. So I didn't hit my head, which I was stoked about. So yeah. I only had a little scratch on the side of my visor.
Yeah.
And I seriously had thought I'd done a lot more damage. Like, I couldn't breathe. My back was in a horrendous amount of pain, and I was just making sure I could feel my toes, and I couldn't lay on a stretcher or bend down. So jeez. Yeah, I thought I'd done a lot more damage than what I did. So when they told me that, I was in a pretty good place. I thought, that's pretty good. You know, I was pretty happy with that. And considering it was just all kind of bone breaks, it wasn't a very invasive procedure to fix it, and there wasn't any extensive digging or tendon realignment or stitching, or like a couple of other injuries I've had in the past, which were a pretty extensive recovery process because of the tendon and ligament and muscle damage. So this one just seemed to be all bone, and I was pretty positive about it, which was good.
Yeah, that's where you'll hear most people who have chronic shoulder injuries, they'd rather take a broken bone over shoulder issues any day, just because, you know, it's not ligaments, it's not all that stuff. So sounds like you definitely avoided some serious injury there. Into my next thing here, I guess it's showing just the level that I mean, we're only, you know, that was only the second round, but for the Enduro World Series, it's showing the level that you guys as riders, I mean, you got 10th place at Punta Ala, you were definitely a title contender. It's just showing how hard you guys are having to push it on the podium and be a top level guy.
Oh, for sure, like the levels definitely stepped up. And you know, the French races were a lot more downhill orientated and very steep, and the whole riding a blind thing was pretty wild. Like, especially for me, like, I guess racing the North American circuit, we get a lot of practice, and even in Punta Al, I didn't really get much practice, but, you know, you got to see the tracks a little bit sort of thing, whereas here you just, you see it once, so you do one run through where you're not allowed to stop, and that's it. Then you go back to the top, line up, go time. And the times were so tight. Like, I think on Saturday I finished about, I think I was 29th overall at the end of the day, and I was 30 seconds off Jared Graves throughout the day. So it was pretty much every stage I was 30 seconds off, 30 seconds off his time. So a minute and a half down, 29th, going into Sunday, I was just like, man, I need to make up 3 seconds a minute.
Yeah.
And when you break it down, 3 seconds a minute, that's very small mistakes frequently kind of thing. That's the difference between jumping on your brakes now or just a click of the fingers later. Yeah. That's it. Or like being in the right gear when you exit every corner.
Just
on the track
rounding
when
out your corners and carrying your momentum in and out.
Yeah, exactly. Little stuff like that. Not getting hung up on that tree root or just, you know, cutting the apex of the corner that little bit, you know. So the level of competition at these enduros is super, super tight, and you can't afford to make a mistake. So, you know, I chatted with my dad, and obviously go through the process once I broke myself, and then I got surgery on the Monday morning, and they fixed it and put some pins and some wire and, you know, put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And, you know, you go through the process the next few days of analyzing what went wrong and how you did it and, you know, why did I huck that tree stump or why didn't I make that corner? And, you know, you just, once you're in that starting line, you almost become unconscious, really, because you just, that's it. You just send it and you just commit to the trail in front of you. And, you know, it's not a, like, you, sure, you have to take a bit of a step back, but at the time I was, and looking back now, hindsight's a magical thing. Looking back now, for sure, I should have, like, just taken one step back so I could finish rather than just try and send it, you know. But, yeah, that's the level that it's at. And I thought at the time that's what I needed to do, and it's what I did. And I think that's where it's heading. You know, you look at all the races from the next weekend in Les Deux Alpes, and they're all super, super tight. You know, they're all seconds separating everyone. Jerome got a 25-second lead in the first stage, and that pretty much won him the event. So, you know, you've got to be on the ball, and you've got to be smart. You've got to be fit. You've got to be fast. You've got to have some kahunas, and you've got to be just aware of what you're doing. So I think the whole level of enduro has just lifted to a whole new stage, and it's rad, and it's awesome, and it's super exciting, and exciting to be a part of. And it makes it even worse now that I'm sitting on the sideline watching.
Yeah, and it's, you know, very much not, you know, it sucks what happened, and you know, not to use an example, but I mean, it just is showing that how hard these guys are having to push, and unfortunately, you're the first guy that's kind of gotten bit by it. You know, it's a shame that it wasn't just a puncture like Burrell's had the last couple of weeks or something.
Yeah, for sure, and that's the game too. Like, the trails we're riding, they're full-on downhill trails on trail bikes, so that there is no room for error. There's a couple of sections where, sure, you can crash or fall over in a corner, or you might slide out on, you know, there's a lot of tight technical sections kind of thing where if you did crash, the outcome would be pretty minimal. Like, there isn't that much risk, but some of these sections are super exposed and just, you know, eye-wateringly fast.
Yeah.
So if you do come unstuck and you do miss it, or you do misread the trail, you're in a world of hurt. Like, and then, you know, looking, I actually found the spot because I ran a helmet cam for my practice run. I found the spot where I crashed, and then watching the Dirt TV recap that they send out after the race, I found the spot where I crashed, and it's at about the 15-minute mark or 14 minutes 50 seconds where they show Jamie Nicol coming into shot.
Yep.
And you can see him coming down the hill, and then he turns right, goes around, off a little drop, turns back left through a creek and back up the hill. Well, that kind of rocky creek bed in the middle there is what I hucked into and just hit the ground at a dead stop.
Jeez.
So, yeah, if I had crashed a little earlier or a little later, it might not have been quite as catastrophic. But, yeah, like you said, that's just the risks we take, and that it's just a mistake that I'll have to learn from.
Just showing the level what we're at. I mean, it's we've three rounds in over in Europe there, and now a couple weeks off for your fellow competitors before they jump across the pond here to North America, which should be interesting how that unfolds. No more super high alpine racing, more down in the tree, especially with Colorado and stuff. So, but you know, I guess give a bit of background for you, because I mean, enduro is so new and everything. Kind of seems like you're tailor made for it. You started off racing motocross and supercross background as a kid, and you didn't really pick up a bike, you know, until the age of 20. And as far as starting to race, do you think that has a bit of an advantage for you? You weren't born and raised on it like most of these kids are nowadays, where they could be burnt out by the age of 20. You were just kind of getting into it fresh-faced and had no expectations.
Yeah, I think for sure that definitely is an advantage of mine, because I'm so keen and eager to get amongst it. But at the same time, I'm 27, so I want, you know, I kind of would like that everything that I see now is like a brand new experience. So I don't have that experience of racing in the past. You know, like you look at a guy like Jared Graves or Fabian Barrel or Jerome Clements, he's been racing this stuff since for the last 10 years, you know, and a lot of these guys have won more world championship events or World Cup events than I have ever done international races. So on one hand, that inexperience is kind of my downfall, but on the other hand, it's good, you know, because I don't really know much about the mountain bike history of the world. You know, like a lot of, like my teammates Adam and Kelly and other guys that I speak to, I just, like, we speak about riders and stuff, and I'll ask, oh, who's that or who's this, and they're like, dude, don't you know who that is? That's Nico Vulies, you know. And I'm like, cool. Like, it's no disrespect or anything like that, but I just haven't grown up in the mountain bike world, and I try not to pay too much attention to what everyone else is doing, because I seem to have a bit of a different approach kind of thing. Maybe because I haven't had that mountain bike background, and I was brought up on motocross, and then just jumping on a mountain bike, I don't know, I just seem to ride it a little differently and approach things a little differently. So I'm not that fussed on getting engrossed in the mountain bike history of the world. I'm more interested in the future and how I can make, I don't know, my program better, so I can be competitive against these guys rather than try and figure out why those guys are so competitive, you know?
Yeah, well, so, and that's it. I mean, it's a bit of a tough break, but I mean, I think, you know, good learning experience. You seem super positive about everything as it is. And I mean, how long are we looking that we're not going to see you on the bike, you know? Like, are you going to be able to come back and race at all later this summer and maybe catch, you know, the last round in Italy at the Final Ligieri, or is that a season write off?
I don't think it's a season write off. Like I said, it's just all broken bones, only bone stuff at the moment. So at this stage, it's hard to tell, because I haven't had any English any English reports to examine it and let me know exactly what my time frame is looking like. But you know, I'd like to be back by the end of the season for sure. You know, Trans-Provence is right before finale, and obviously the final round in Italy in October. So, yeah, it's hard to say at this stage, but I definitely want to be back racing before the summer's out and before the season finishes. So whether that's for finale at the end of the year or whether it's at the Mount Hood Oregon Enduro finals down there at the beginning of September, I'm not too sure at this stage, but as soon as I find out some information and as soon as I can, I'll be doing everything possible to try and get back on that bike. So yeah, it's just a waiting game at the moment. All I know is that I can't really move anything for the next 3 to 4 weeks to let the bones heal.
Yeah.
And then, we'll reassess from there. And hopefully at that stage, I'll have my sling off and be at least mobile by the time Whistler Crankworks comes around and be able to see everyone up at Whistler at the Enduro there. And who knows? I'll hopefully have a lot more information by that stage and be in a lot better position.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it'll be good to see you up here come that time. It's a shame that we won't have you out on the course, but be good to see you out there and catch up with everybody. I mean, that's the Whistler round's definitely shaping up to be could be one of the best rounds out there. I mean, it's they've only done it a few years. Obviously, it's not as established as all these other events, and that's the Sven was on earlier on the show here, and he was just chatting about how you know, at Les Delt there, it's hard. It was a first year event. It wasn't the Mountain of Hell anymore. Different style event and pretty loose flagging and everything like that. So I'm excited to see what's happening these next couple rounds here with us being back in North America. So
for sure, I think the Colorado one last year and even the Whistler event last year, the stages and the races were pretty sweet. You know, the Colorado one had a really good variation of stages from stage one to the final stage that started at Mary Jane's Peak, you know, 13,000 feet. So they had, for the, I think it was 5 stages over the 3 days.
Yeah.
There was a really good variation of all kinds of mountain biking, you know, and it was a good representation of enduro. There was pedaling, there was downhill, there was technical stuff, there was some gnar, there was jumps, it was pretty cool. And same with the Crankworks event last year. Sure, the timing might have been a bit of a stuff up, but the event itself and the trails itself were sweet. So, yeah, I'm excited to see how these Euros and this whole crowd goes back here on the North American circuit. And I really hope that the guys up there in Whistler and in Colorado can put on a great show, which I have no doubt they will. You know, the whole series is exploding at the moment, and I think it's a great time for North America to get involved and to showcase what Colorado has and Whistler, which is sweet. So hopefully we see it back here for the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping, as much as they're not connected, that the Enduro World Series being back in Colorado could bring a World Cup DH back there. I mean, there used to be so many back in the day in the States, and let alone Colorado. So, and I know the Whistler organizers are especially living up here, working hard at putting together a good course, and their lips are sealed. They're I think we'll see some good tracks. But who knows what we're going to be racing. I have no clue whatsoever. So,
yeah.
But I guess because we were hoping to have you on the last show, actually, we'd put out a tweet to our listeners there. You know, if they have any questions for you, hit us up. And we actually did have quite a few listeners reach out to us and some questions for you. So I'm going to go through. We got a few to start off with. So Danielle from Wichita wants to know, how do you manage frothing? You always seem to be talking about it. She tried a cream she got from the doctor, but it didn't go away. How do you manage living with so much froth?
Well, sometimes the froth bites you and it puts you in the position that I'm in now. So it's definitely hard to contain. How do I contain it? I'll get back to you. I haven't worked it out yet. It's another piece of the puzzle which I haven't figured out how to control, and it leads me to the position that I'm in now. So yeah, as long as you can take a breath and think before you leap, that's probably a good place to start to try and control the froth, that's for sure.
I know Dylan Wolski has the same issue. He has a frothing issue. Maybe it's just a regional thing from where you guys are born.
Yeah, maybe it's a gong show. Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's a gong thing.
And then what do we got here? JP from Sherbrooke, Quebec asks, tell us about how you used to ride motocross. Didn't really elaborate, but were you a bit of a reckless rider on the old dirt bike there when you were younger? Or?
I don't know, maybe. Yeah, a little bit. I used to race. I raced from when I was maybe 11, I think. I got my first 1996, so it was my first CR80, which I started racing and riding in unrode peewees as a little baby at 4 years old. And I just grew up racing at home in Wollongong and racing the local scene, and then stepped up to state titles and stuff when I got a little older and into the junior 125 ranks. And then that progressed into when I turned senior at 16 and started racing more state opens. And then obviously then the next process was going to the national titles and doing the national motocross series and national supercross series, as well as the state supercross, motocross, and stadium motocross series. So I seem to do okay, I think. I'm not too sure. I think I was all right. I'd won a few stadium motocrosses and won a few of the series in 2003 and 2004. I was up there in the series and stuff, and around the top 20 mark and the odd top 15 at the national motocross rounds. And yeah, it was good fun. It was really good fun. We had a good crew in Wollongong and good bunch of guys to train with, and we used to go to the gym together and run and ride motocross and supercross, and it was good times. Whether I was reckless, not too sure. I had a few rowdy moments, which was pretty crazy, which looking back now was pretty out there, which I definitely think you could call reckless. I hit there was a race in Tamworth, which is central New South Wales back home, and it was a stadium motocross race, and this is kind of off topic, but it was a you come out of this turn and hit the ski jump at third gear, and then just as soon as you land you could floor it, and there was four single jumps following.
Yeah.
And all day people had just been triple and singling.
Yeah.
A triple into it and then single out. And I was looking at it at Dad during practice, and I thought, I wonder if you can quad this. And Dad was like, oh, yeah, maybe. And a couple of other guys heard me, and they just started giggling, thinking I was stupid. Anyway, the heat race, I don't know, again, a little bit of froth came out, and I just come off this ski jump and thought, I'm going to send this, send it, and quadded this jump, which then went into a as soon as you land, you would pretty much get off the gas, start braking into a tabletop, and then like a really sharp right-hand turn.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a commitment. And so anyway, I'd made this jump all night in the heat race. The crowd was going crazy, and it was awesome fun to do. And, you know, I could see the flash bulbs popping in the stands, you know, all that cliche shit. And,
yeah.
Yeah, that night I think I had to maintain a third position to get third overall in that series for the year. And yeah, I hit this jump, and I hit it once, and it was sweet. The next time I was getting a little bit tired and come up short, hit it again, come up even shorter, come around the next lap, and it was like the 15th lap of a 20-lap final, and I just sent it again, and then come up way short on this quad, landed off the thing, and then a whiskey throttle into this next tabletop, and because there was so many braking bumps, I was just totally out of control, and hit this tabletop full pinned, and next to the tabletop there was a semi-trailer. Yeah. There that was for the lap scoring and timing and stuff, and behind that was the grandstand. So I'd hit this jump and just jumped above this semi-trailer, and I remember looking down and I could see the down ramp disappear. Then I'm like, it's okay, I can down ramp the berm disappeared, and I was still in the air, still sailing. And then it was just grass field in front of me. I was like, uh-oh, just landed with the gas on and just somehow made it. It must have been a 160 odd foot jump to flat, but it wasn't ideal. And then landed.
Sight to see.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, and then I landed, looked up, and I'm like, holy shit! Hit the brakes, turned around, come pinning it back up the start straight, back on the track, and I was still in third position, which I held for the rest of the night, which is handy. Dad was in the crowd, and he said they went as soon as I jumped off this thing, everyone went dead silent. And they just saw me disappear down behind this semi-trailer. And then they just hear this 250 just come screaming back up the straight, and everyone went crazy, and that was pretty cool. So I guess that was my one of my most reckless moments on a motocross bike.
Nice.
Which
nice.
Is good fun.
Well, the second part of the question is, how did your dad take it when you told him you wanted to race XC instead?
He was sweet. Yeah, he was kind of the instigator of the whole thing, because I stopped racing motocross in 2005. I just had a crash and just broke my wrist, and I guess it wasn't that big of a deal, the actual break, but at the time it was just a bit of a tough time for my dad and I for racing and financially affording to do it all. And we were like, well, we either commit to this and make it happen, or pull the pin and you pay for your bikes and you get a job and kind of look at the rest of your life and try and set yourself up before you reassess what you're going to do. So we opted to pull the pin and, you know, go down the get a life track instead of chasing the dream of being a pro motocrosser track. And like maybe 6 months later or 7 months later, I was just kind of partying and working as a laborer and not really doing a great deal, doing a bunch of motocross coaching and stuff. And Dad said, why don't you go into a mountain bike race?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, yeah. What's this mountain biking stuff?
Yeah.
And just literally Googled it, looked up Wollongong Mountain Bike Club, and there happened to be a race that next weekend in the mountain, in a forest over the mountain kind of thing. And
yeah.
Went over there, and I just happened to win my class, and I was second outright that day, and that was it. I was on like a $500 bike and with joggers and a visor under my hat and no idea what I was doing. So, I come home frothing about it big time, and I didn't really think too much of it. It was good fun, and I just thought, oh, yeah, sweet, I'm going to start riding and doing some of this stuff. And, I went on to be a motocross coach for the next year pretty much, and then become a landscaper and started to think a little bit more about this mountain biking stuff. I bought a giant Anthem in 2007 just to keep riding. And in 2008, I thought, yeah, this cross country is pretty cool. If I get fit, I might do all right. And I got third in a state championships in the cross country in the elite men, the pro men. And then the next year, I trained even harder with my coach, Mark Fenner of FTPtraining.com. And then all of a sudden in 2010, I got third in the Australian elite cross country championships. So Dad was totally supportive of it. He thought it was cool. He thought it was a good strength of mine, and it was good for my lifestyle and good for me as a person, kind of thing. And yeah, it kind of gave my competitive edge a good feeding. and it was good fun. So now at home, actually, he rides my old bikes. So he's getting into a bunch of riding, and he rides around the cycleways at home and has coffees, and he looks after all my old bikes and stuff, which is really cool.
Oh, right on.
So, that was a way massive answer to the question, but yeah, he's stoked on it. He's very supportive of me racing cross country, and now that I'm racing enduro, he's even more pumped on it. And my mum and dad are coming over for Crankworx Whistler, and they're really looking forward to checking it out. And unfortunately, they won't see me race, but they're really excited to come and see it.
Oh yeah, you'll have to get them up top of the world there, get them up on the peak chair, and watch everybody drop in if that's going to be the final stage like it was last year, to check out that. That'll probably give them a pretty good idea considering how long it takes to get up there, what you go through as a racer to get all the way back down to the bottom, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that'll be something I'll definitely see, and everyone should see. If anyone's going to Whistler to check her out, they should definitely take that route up the hill just to see the area and, like you just said, see exactly what we race down and how long it takes. It's pretty cool. I think for people who don't exactly understand what enduro is and what we do, and when they finally see something like that and how high we go and how far we come down the mountain, it's a bit of an eye-opening experience for everyone, which is cool, really cool.
Fair enough. And then we have one other question, two-part. Adam from Vancouver asks, jam or jelly?
It's jam. Jelly is like something you put in a little cup and you eat with a spoon. Jam is something that you spread on a sandwich and have a sandwich with. So it's a peanut butter and jam sandwich.
And then the second part is, who do you think made up these questions?
I have a fair idea, and I think he may be a Wolverine mate of mine.
There is a couple other in there, and I think had he pretended to be a phone-in caller to you, it would probably be even more ridiculous. But that would be from our Dunbar friend there, Mr. Adam Mantle. There were some kind of classic ones. I think he would have been able to pull them off pretty good.
That's funny.
I had to change it. That first one, I was like thinking I'd get a little answer at the end. Really, it was just trying to line it up. He wanted to know, did your dad cry when you told him you wanted to race XC instead? And how did you manage the shame?
Yeah, no, there was no shame. It's definitely an interesting thing when you're racing cross country, and you know, racing road cycles goes hand in hand with racing cross country. So when you start to shave your legs and then you start to eat a lot of salad and get real skinny and fuss about your weight and shave your legs frequently, and it's definitely an interesting thing to tell to your dad. That's for sure. You know, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just going to shave my legs and have a salad. That's interesting.
Yeah. Cool, son. I'm glad you're making good life choices. Oh,
good job. Lucky I had a girlfriend at the time who now turned into my fiance, so it wasn't too shocking. Then it was just even harder to tell her, oh, what are you doing? Oh, I'm just going to shave my legs and have a salad. She's thinking, what?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I started dating a motocross rider.
Is it too late to back out now?
Yeah, true story. She hung around, and she's here with me in Canada as we speak, so couldn't have done too bad.
Well, Josh, I definitely want to thank you for taking the time to join us here on the show and bring us up to speed with your injury and everything, and just your background and what we can look forward to later on in the year, and just your insight of what's actually happening at each and every round here and just how hard these guys are pushing it. So
for sure, no worries. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it, how these next few weeks unfold. You know, being on this side of the fence, I'm just with this enduro stuff, I'm becoming just as much as a fan as everyone else. So when I'm not behind the start gate now that I'm behind the computer screen, I'm kind of watching as eager as everyone else is at home. So, yeah, I hope everyone's as excited about it as I am. And, yeah, hopefully I can be behind that Stargate sooner rather than later.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, it's good to hear you're in good spirits and you're on the mend and everything. And, again, thanks for joining us here. That's Giant Factory Racing, Josh Carlson. So, Josh, we'll let you go right now. And, again, thanks for your time. And we'll catch up with you in the next couple weeks here.
Great. No worries. Thanks for having me on your show.
Always a great interview, that Josh Carlson. Glad we had him on the show, and glad we were able to catch up with him and just find out exactly what happened at Val d'Alos and how he's doing as a rider as we chatted there. It's unfortunate that he had such a giant get-off, but I think it sets the tone of exactly just how hard these riders are pushing at each and every round of the Enduro World Series. You know, everybody keeps referring to it as it's downhill racing on little bikes, so you know, they're riding fast, they're taking chances. So, and yeah, so that does about things for us today here at the Off Track Show. We'll be off for a week or two here before we come back later on this month, where we'll be catching up doing the Winter Park Enduro World Series and, of course, Andorra World Cup. So, in the meantime, though, listeners can stay up to date with everything by following us on our Twitter account. Just want to remind everybody, if you want to reach out to us, give us some feedback. Let us know what you think of our programming here. So hit us up at off_track MTB or fire through an email, offtrackshow@gmail.com. And there we can get in touch with you. We can, you know, field up any questions and take any feedback you guys have. And, of course, going into our next little bit here, probably one of the best Instagram feeds out there. Stay up to date. Sven Martin is keeping everything going at the Off Track Show there. So off_track on Instagram. You can stay up to date with all the details and everything that's going on. So, and from everybody here at the Off Track Show, I'd like to thank you guys for taking the time to listen. Again, big thanks to our sponsor, BikeMag.com. And we'll catch you guys in a couple weeks at Winter Park, Colorado.